If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/wondery. rocketmoney.com/wondery.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, everyone. Seth Meyers here. Welcome to another episode of Late Night Lit, our podcast series that celebrates books and authors we love. I'm going to turn things over to Sarah Jenks Daly, a supervising producer at Late Night and the host of Late Night Lit. Take it away, Sarah.
Hi, everyone. I'm Sarah Jenks Daly, and welcome to Late Night Lit. This month, we're featuring three wonderful guests that I thoroughly enjoyed speaking to. First, Joe Piazza and Christine Pride, authors of the powerful new novel, We Are Not Like Them, and filmmaker and photographer, Jillian Laub, who recently published a beautiful new book, Family Matters. We'll also hear book recommendations from two late night staffers. Christine Pride and Joe Piazza are our first guests this month, and they are longtime publishing industry veterans. Joe, a prolific and talented author, and Christine, a highly sought-after and well-respected book editor. They're also friends, and they embarked upon the tall task of writing a novel together. We Are Not Like Them, which is destined to be a book club favorite, is a story about two childhood best friends, Jen, a white woman, and Riley, a black woman, whose now adult friendship drastically shifts when an unarmed black teenager is shot by a police officer in Philadelphia. Christine and Joe not only reckon with difficult questions about how race can impact friendships, but also touch upon themes of community, policing in America, given families and chosen families, and motherhood. Now here's my conversation with Christine and Joe. Hi, everybody. Welcome to Late Night Lit. Joining us today are two authors, Joe Piazza and Christine Pride. Hi, you two.
Hello.
Hey, how you doing?
You are our first double interview, and I'm very excited you're both here, even though none of us are together.
Together on Zoom, which is the new together.
Sure it is. Sure. So the reason you two are on is you wrote this fantastic book, We Are Not Like Them, and you wrote it together. And I want to talk about the book and the process, but I thought at first we could begin by how you two know each other. So Christine, do you want to start? How did you first meet?
Sure. So I was actually Jo's editor for her last novel, Charlotte Walsh Likes to Win, at Simon & Schuster. So we worked together on that and a very traditional, you know, editor-author relationship, which was really fun. And we actually had this real spark, right? When you meet somebody, and we worked so well professionally, but we also had so much fun together and so much in common. And then we worked on another book together immediately after that, which was a tie-in to the television show Younger. And it was a book that I published at Simon & Schuster that they published on the show and then in real life. And I needed a writer to write that really quickly. And Joe is good and fast. And so I asked her if she would do it. But we had a 4 to 5 week turnaround for this book. And so we were really in it. And when I say in it, I mean in a Google Doc, really both of us, you know, kind of writing together. And from that experience, again, working well, so well together and having so much fun and turning out a great product, I think it was a really good book.
Yeah, it was good book.
We decided to start talking about what else we could work on together. And I'd had this idea kind of kicking around about a friendship between a black woman and a white woman that was affected by a police shooting. And this is, you know, was directly kind of ripped from the horrible headlines that come in these waves. And it was a time of one of the waves in spring 2018. And it felt really, it felt like an important topic, but one that we could approach in a unique way by writing together. And so we started talking, and We Are Not Like Them was born.
So you mentioned this idea kicking around. Joe, were you hesitant or excited or all of those things when you thought about writing a book with somebody else? Because I think writing a novel itself, which you've had experience with, is a difficult enough task. But then to attempt to do that with somebody, what did you feel like going into it?
Oh, writing with someone else is hard. I mean, writing a novel is really, really difficult. Writing a novel about race, I knew, and social justice was going to be hard. And then add on a layer of writing with a partner, and it could have been impossible. And it was hard. We had put in a lot of hard work for 3 years to get We Are Not Like Them where it is right now, you know, about to be in people's hands. That said, with the right writing partner, it's freaking awesome to have a partner, because writing and being an author is a lonely business. So there was something really magical once we kind of nailed it, once we got into our groove, about having someone to create with. Because when you're writing, you really are creating something from scratch. You're giving birth to something. And to be able to do that with another person was really, really special.
So the novel, Christine, you sort of set it up, but it's about two friends, 30-something women living in Philadelphia, Riley and Jen. One is a Black woman, one is a white woman, and the friendship radically shifts when there's this police shooting of a young Black man. So the novel is centered around race, and you two, like your characters, are different races. How much did life inform art in that way?
Yeah, when we're on podcasts, we kind of have to remind ourselves to be like, tell them that we're different races. which in any other context to announce that would be weird, but in audio,
I'm a Black woman.
Hello, and I'm Joe, and I'm a white woman. But we know there's a statistic that says that 75% of white people in America don't have a friend of another race, and I think that holds up. If you look around, you can see just how segregated, by choice and but for so many other reasons, a lot of our friend groups are. Mm-hmm. So in order to write this book, Christine and I were also having difficult conversations about race. Difficult for me because as a white woman who's been in very white spaces, I haven't had them with a close friend before. As our friendship was growing and our professional relationship was growing, and we tried to get all of that onto the page and use it to inform both of our characters.
An interesting thing, I think, at least for me as a white woman, watching the last 2 years unfold and the sort of racial reckoning that happened in our country, was like the thought of not really having to consider race was a luxury for me, because it's something, of course, you think about. But as a person who's white, it's not something you have to think about every day. So was that something that came up, Christine, like for you talking about this book with a white woman as opposed to your experience?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that in the same way that our characters, Riley and Jen, because they met when they were so young, they were, you know, 5 years old, and they're not talking about race on the playground while they're jumping rope or whatever. And then that just became, they just never talked about it until they were forced to talk about it, right? And I think they had different motivations for that that play out in real life too. Like Riley, I think, carries a lot of fear about talking about race, and it's easier for her to compartmentalize. And when I say her fear, a lot of it is based on worrying about what the reaction is going to be. If I bring this up to, in this case, you know, my friend Jen, will I be met with dismissiveness, or will she be, you know, completely fragile about this, or will she be defensive, right? Any of these predictable reactions we often see. And so it was kind of easier for her to avoid the subject altogether. And in Jen's case, it's a little bit like what you were talking about, where she never had to think about it, which is a luxury. It hadn't really played out in her life, even though, you know, she has this close Black friend, until it does, right? Until they're forced to have these conversations. And in a way, life mirrored art for Joe and I to have to do that too, right? Like race wasn't something that Joe was thinking about on a daily basis in the same way that I have been since I was since I started existing in America. You know what I mean? Like, it's something that you live and breathe and it's part of your life, and at the family dinner table growing up, and, you know, Black parents have this responsibility to bring up race and burden, potentially, to bring up race to their children from a very young age to prepare them for the world that they're going to be entering. And that's a difficult balance too, right? Like, how much do you talk about, so these are the horrible things that might happen to you in the world, versus I'm just going to let you be a child. I think that's something we also touch on in the book in terms of Riley's experiences in her family.
Definitely. There were so many different themes, race being the central one, but even like motherhood and friendship and families. And I really love how you weaved all those things together. In terms of the writing process, how did that work? I'm sure you get asked, like, are you this character? Are you this person? But did you send each other pages and make a conscious effort to remove yourself from certain things that people might assume? Like, what was the process there and how did you find your way to it?
First off, I introduced Christine to Google Docs.
Kicking and screaming, I have to say.
She did not want to come. She did not want to come to my world. And but it's the only way that you can collaborate with someone on a project this big. We couldn't trade documents back and forth. And in the beginning, because I'm an author and Christine is an editor, we fell into those roles. So I would put something down on the blank page and then she would go in and maybe rip the whole thing up and rewrite it. But at least she wasn't having to approach a blank page, which is scary. Mm-hmm. But once we got really comfortable with the novel and once the characters, I think I always say the book tells you what it wants to be and the characters come to you and tell you what they want to be and who they want to be. It just became this furious back and forth and on text and on email and on every imaginable form of communication. Like, oh, I've got this for this scene. This just popped into my head while I was in the shower. I thought of this while I was on a run. And then the other one being like, all right, you go in, you do this. Let me know when you're out of the dock. And then it's like, I can see you in the dock. Are you in? Are you in? Are you out? Are you out? They see like the little mouse in the corner. And so it was just, we had an outline and then each of us just kept putting layer after layer. And I think after a while, we stopped thinking about who, I wasn't doing the white woman and Christine wasn't doing the Black woman. Like, we were just doing this story together. And our biggest thing was to make sure that the two women had completely different voices, but that the book felt cohesive. So you couldn't tell it was written by two authors.
Yeah, you definitely succeeded there.
Thank you.
But I think it's important, even though people will assume that, you know, sort of I'm the Black character and Joe's the white character. That wasn't the case. But we wrote this book together and we chose to tell it together for a reason, which is that we were bringing different experiences and perspectives to the table, right? So it was a balance really of both. And so much of the book, which is, you know, really important to us, is based on personal experiences, based on conversations that we have overheard or participated in, right? Depending. And Joe and I are hearing different conversations. She's in spaces where people might say something that they would never say in front of me and vice versa. And so we were able to bring those things to the table in a way that we wouldn't have been if either of us wrote the book individually. That adds to the authenticity of it, and that these two different experiences and perspectives are both grounded in reality.
Yeah, I think that's a really special thing that you both got those different perspectives that people might not share otherwise, which is not something you really think about until maybe it's real.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I am privy to conversations in an all-white space that someone would never have around a Black person. And we wanted to get that on the page. We wanted to be in the characters' heads to hear what they think and then see what they say, because there's also always a disconnect between that, too. And so some of the conversations, I will say, I think are hard to read, but I think a lot of people will recognize them, and then that will be a starting point for, you know, what is not okay, what is not okay to say, what is okay to say, and how can we keep talking about this?
You mentioned this like 3-year process of writing. Christine, you said it came sort of in these waves of violence against Black bodies. When you started, where were you in terms of when the murder of George Floyd happened and the Black Lives Matter movement of 2020 that maybe served as reminders of like what story you were trying to tell? Like, where were you in that process?
Yeah, you know, this book in a way has really tragic bookends in terms of when we started writing in March 2018, it was in, you know, we were still in the, you know, sort of Ferguson aftermath, right? Mm-hmm. Which launched this, Black Lives Matter, of course, but, you know, Stephon Clark had just been killed, shot, and there had been a wave. And then we finished, meaning, you know, the book was really done, edited, like to bed in April 2020, weeks before George Floyd's murder. And so it's really, you know, it's really hard to think about those bookends, but they were also motivating in a way, because this is why we wrote this book, right? To really take readers behind and beyond these headlines that we see so much, and that people can become desensitized to, or, you know, just kind of pass in a blur, certainly pre-George Floyd. And then the world changed, right, in May 2020, in a lot of ways for the better, and that people are more aware of these things, more open to having conversations about race in our society, and their role in it, who's complicit, et cetera. And so that was almost even more motivating for us timing-wise, in that we want our book to be a part of this conversation,
right,
people are having, and a tool for people to say, right, I read this. I mean, just as you just mentioned, like, this part made me feel this way, or I realized I do this, to make it feel personal to your life. But we also did make some adjustments to the book in the post George Floyd era, mainly around this idea of justice, right? And there was a sense, and we did a ton of research for this book, although the statistics would not be surprising, that, you know, they were dismal when it came to indictments, let alone convictions,
right,
for police officers. Without giving away any spoilers, our initial version hewed closer to the reality of those statistics. Post George Floyd, there was a real hunger that we still feel, and certainly felt before, but for justice, right? So what does justice look like? And which is something our book interrogates. What will set things right? What is forgiveness? You know, what are the consequences, and what's appropriate? And we had to do a lot of thinking about that as we went back in. And then we made some adjustments along those lines, which readers will learn about when they read the book.
Yeah, hopefully. Definitely. Joe, I would imagine this is like a big book club book, or I could see, like, myself, if I were teaching a class for kids in high school, this would be something I put on a syllabus, you know, just for a conversation. Have you heard from people who are having conversations that they wouldn't have had previously?
Oh my God. Yes. Yes. So many. We're so lucky because so many of the reviews have said, oh my gosh, this book is going to launch thousands of book club conversations, and this book is destined for book club gold, which we're like, oh my God, like, that's amazing. But I got a text last night from a friend who, you know, grew up in a very working class white family and not unlike mine. And she's like, I just finished the book. I gave her an early copy, and her text was just, oh my God, I'm changed. And
that's amazing.
It's amazing, right? But we've done some events with really diverse events, also with men who are not necessarily our target audience for this book. But one where an older white man was reading the book alongside a younger black man, and the older white man, who was from the South, by the way, said that he cried at the epilogue, and that the book also changed how he viewed all of his relationships with his friends. And the black man said that he was changed by realizing how much of an identity that policing is. So he took something completely different away from this. And what we've noticed is that everyone kind of holds on to something else. So there really are so many conversations to be started from this. People are telling us that they're conversations they wouldn't have been able to have otherwise. And this is going back to what Christine said about fear. You know, black people are afraid of the reaction that they're going to get when they bring up race. Like, are they going to be defensive? Are they going to say something dismissive? And white people are afraid of saying the wrong thing, of being stupid, of seeming ignorant, of insulting people. So we've both got so much fear on both sides, but the book allows you to talk about the characters. And so then you're comfortable and you can get into these hard conversations without talking about yourself, which is usually the hardest place to start.
That's so true. That's so great that people
having to go up to somebody and say, like, do you want to talk about race right now? You know, or something topical. There's a more subtle way into the conversation.
Yeah, I mean, no white person should ever just, you know, start at a dinner party. Well, here's what I thought about George Floyd's murder. So, like, but hey, did you read this book? That's easier.
Yeah, that's great that there's been that reception, because I'm sure that when you dreamed of what this would look like and when it was finally published, that it would have a ripple effect and it would resonate with people. I think that's probably, you know, book advance aside, all that you really want.
It is.
And it's so gratifying because it was hard. I mean, Joe and I had to have so many hard conversations getting here. We reached so many, you know, on the brink moments, and writing itself is hard. And the one thing that really kept us going and kept us motivating was this idea that if we kept, you know, our eyes on the prize that and finish this, like, this book could do something. And as an editor, it's, which I've been for 20 years, you know, it's really a special opportunity when you see a book that can have multiple audiences. And that if you can look out in a crowd of people who come to a book and you see just as many Black readers, for example, as white readers who are saying, I saw myself, I was affirmed, you know, I really related to this, and white readers saying that it's not, you know, kind of pandering to one audience or another, if you will, that's really unique. Like, I feel like we've the outcome of this is something unique. And really, when you see that, really, really meaningful. And so we've been in tears a lot, I have to say.
We cry a lot. You know, we're happy. We are happy. But we do also want to say, you know, at its heart, this is a novel. And it's a novel that the core of it is this lifelong friendship between these two women and how much they truly do love each other. And can they get through this incredibly difficult and tragic event and come out on the other side? Christine and I, you know, we're big readers. Obviously, Christine's a book editor. I'm an author. But so many books are focused on romantic love and romantic relationships. And for us, our friendships, our girlfriends are the backbones of our lives. And we wanted to see that on the page. We wanted to see a life-sustaining, lifelong friendship between two women and how important that is, and celebrate that. And I hope that we got to do that with We Are Not Like Them.
I think you both did. It was really a really wonderful read.
Thank you.
Thank you. That really means a lot, Sarah.
Lastly, I would love to know if you have any books that you'd like to recommend to our listeners. Christine, do you want to share first?
I just started reading Kate Buller's No Cure for Being Human. And I loved her first book, Everything Happens for a Reason, I believe. I hope I'm getting that right. I'm a huge fan of hers. And it's just very, it's a memoir. It's very life-affirming, very just so emotional. I'm, you know, 20 pages in, but it's the perfect book to read at this time where life in general feels crazy. My personal life feels a little crazy in exciting ways, but this book has just, I've been reading a little every night, and it's very grounding and just very reminding us of, you know, kind of what matters, why we're all here, how we can be better humans. And I'm just really loving it.
Oh, great. Okay. Check that one out. And Joe?
I also just started reading Kate Buller's book. I did.
This
I started reading it last night.
To us, we start books at the same without even realizing.
I know. And I love it. And I love her. I'm a huge fan of hers. I want to have her on one of my podcasts, actually. But I loved the novel Paper Palace, which came out, I think, a couple months ago now at this point. But I loved it because I really enjoyed seeing a female heroine in her 50s with just like a vibrant inner life and a romance. And, you know, I don't think that we see women over a certain age enough in fiction. And this one really did the trick for me. And then Christine and I have one that we love together that we can't stop talking about, that we're obsessed with, which is Great Circle by Maggie Shipstead.
Oh, yes. I haven't read it yet. I have it right here. I haven't read it yet.
So good. Yes. We kept just saying, how does she do this? She knows so much about everything and every century. And
yeah, and every kind of person, and Maggie Shipp, like, again, and flight, and World War One, and World War Two, and we're just like, why is Maggie Shipstead the smartest person on the planet, and also such a great writer, and oh my God, we should never do anything ever again.
Oh, well, I have to read that one. It's on my list. So hearing you two loved it,
reaffirms
it. Okay, good, yeah. Good. Well, thank you two so much for doing this. It was really such a pleasure, and I loved the book so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. We love chatting with you. This has been really such a treat. So fun.
We'll be right back with Jillian Laub. Our next guest is award-winning filmmaker and photographer Jillian Laub, author of the new book, Family Matters. Jillian has traveled all over the world documenting subjects and communities, both abroad and here in America, in her previous projects, Testimony and Southern Rights. But as she talks about today, Family Matters is by far the most personal. And she focuses her lens on her own family amidst the backdrop of a Donald Trump presidency and a global pandemic. And for those of you in the New York area, the book comes to life in the form of an exhibition at the International Center of Photography now through January 10th. Here's my conversation with Jillian. We are here with Jillian Laub. Hi, Jillian.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Congratulations on this beautiful book called Family Matters. You're a photographer and journalist, and your previous published work has focused on documenting subjects that I know you were deeply connected to, but not genetically related to.
That is correct.
Can you tell us a little bit about that work prior to writing this book, Family Matters?
Yes. So I've been working as a photographer for over 20 years, which makes me feel a little old right now. The first big project I did was in the Middle East, and it's titled Testimony. And I spent about 6 years collecting portraits and testimonies of Israeli Jews, Israeli Arabs, and Palestinians, all affected by the Second Intifada. And then my second project was titled Southern Rights, and it's kind of a multi-platform project. It began with photographing segregated proms and homecoming rituals in the South, and then evolved into a documentary film, which really focused then on a racially charged murder that happened in the same community. And it's now a traveling exhibition and a book. So quite different from turning the camera on my family, but also there is similarity because I look at all of these communities as one kind of big loving and dysfunctional family, mm-hmm. which is what my family is.
Well, this book depicts your extended family while also depicting what it was like to feel so diametrically opposed to the people that you love the most during this Donald Trump presidency. And you start the book with the story about seeing your family through someone else's eyes. Can you just like briefly tell that story and why you chose that as the jumping off point?
Yeah. So that was a pivotal moment. I was in art school in 1999 on the Upper East Side. I was studying photography. And, you know, I was really trying to be taken seriously as an artist. And we're out on our cigarette break with all my students and our professor and this Norwegian guy who was doing a project about capitalism in America pointed to some women across the street, like in disgust, wearing fur coats. And he's like, oh, look at those vulgar women in their fancy fur coats. And I was like, oh, yeah, God. And like, as they came closer to me, I realized that it's my mom, my grandmother, and my great aunt on their art appreciation class tour group. And as they're coming closer, my heart is beating out of my chest and I feel like I'm starting to sweat. And they're like, Jillian, oh my God, what are you doing up here? So I thought I would die. And basically, that's where it kind of all began, because my worlds felt like they were colliding. But there was something really interesting also about that tension, because on one hand, you know, I think we can all appreciate like that you're, you know, you love your family, you feel proud of them, but also mortified by them at the same time.
Of course.
So, you know, they were really like incredibly visual too. So that's kind of where I began, the moment that it strikes in my head of when and where I began photographing them.
Obviously, this is a very personal story, and you talk about your family's ancestry and culture and photographs that you've taken over decades, I'd imagine. And then obviously the particular focus on the last 4 or 5 years, which were, I think, as many of us experienced, extremely intense and volatile in many ways. It seemed like some of these memories and moments that you share, they're just incredibly vivid. So I was wondering, when you see these pictures and you're putting this together, did the stories that were attached to them in your brain, did they come back easily to you, or were they things you had written down?
So I think these memories and these moments, and why I'm actually a photographer, is because these images create such a visceral feeling inside of me. So I do write everything down, but it's really driven by the pictures. When I put this book together, I edited through the pictures and then I started writing.
You said that you started photography school in 1999. So I'd imagine pictures go back that many years. You must have had thousands to go through.
Tens of thousands of photographs to go through. I mean, that actually took really 2 years to go to really edit down to what I felt crystallized this narrative the best way.
There's one picture that you talk about. I think it's your nephew's bedroom that he said you could take, but he didn't want to be in it because he didn't want to be judged. How did you, did some not make the cut because of that personal comfort level?
Yeah. So I think that when you're photographing people, and this goes for me in general, you know, ethically, I think it's important to obviously have the consent of whomever you're photographing. So my nephew really did not feel comfortable having, and let me tell you, I lost sleep over this, because for me, that was the most powerful picture at that moment in my book. I thought it said so much, and he did not want me to publish that picture. So I had to, you know, that's happened a bunch of times, but obviously it's no question. I can't publish something that somebody asked me not to publish.
Right. You also share text message threads between you and your parents, your sister and brother-in-law. And that led me to want to ask, how did you approach them about saying, I want to include this? There's like a transcript of a conversation.
Yeah, that's trickier, because I took the liberty and I edited our text messages, thinking I would protect people as well, because these are, when I tell you, you know, 100 pages of text messages, a family group text. So that was a big decision to go through all of these text messages. There were, you know, times where I felt, okay, I can't reproduce these. It's too personal. But in the end, I realized that I had to reproduce them because they were so important to the narrative, because there were so many times where this is the only way that we communicated. So, you know, obviously I'm not going to reproduce something that's going to hurt anyone, but I also didn't want to lose the authenticity of what the story, how important these texts were in our communication over 5 years.
So you put those together, you put the pictures together, you have this final book. How did you share the final product, and were you nervous?
I was terrified. So my parents' best friend, who's in the book as well, Bonnie, their Biden-loving friend, is incredibly protective over them. So she would never let me put anything in print that was going to hurt anyone. And that's, you know, that was the last thing I wanted to do. But I, you know, wanted to be authentic and tell a true story. So she was really my reader. She read drafts. But I didn't show my family the text. They saw every photograph that was going into the book, but I did not show them the text because I really didn't want creative input, because I'm sensitive and it would have had an influence on me, what they thought. So I also didn't want to show them a PDF. So what I did when I got the final copy of the book, the hardcover, I made an appointment with them to come over and sit with them as they read it. And it's a book that's meant to be read from cover to cover, even though it's a photo book.
Right.
But I made the text so that you can actually read this in one sitting. Mm-hmm. So it's not dense. And I sat with them while they read the book for the first time.
That must have been very emotional.
It was incredibly emotional. There was lots of laughs. There was lots of tears. And the incredible thing, though, is that they didn't have ego about it. Like, they really were not concerned with how they looked or how they were portrayed because they trusted me. The biggest takeaway that I was just so floored by is that they just respected the honesty. Like, there were hard things in the book that I know were hard for them, but they really respected the honesty. And we had one of the most transparent, it was like a breakthrough moment, really. And we've had really transparent conversations like we've never had since they read the book.
It's pretty remarkable to have this visual benchmark of exactly both how you were feeling, but what was happening. So when you look back on it now, I was wondering now, like, we're almost a year into this Biden presidency, looking back on all of the things you took pictures of, that you texted, is there anything that you wish you had known or maybe would have done differently?
You know, I think it's important to go through what you go through. You know, there's, of course, there's moments where I'm ashamed of my own behavior. I wish that they acted different. I wish, of course, there's embarrassment and shame, right? Because the past few years brought out the worst in people, truly brought out the worst in people. So I regret letting so much toxicity in my life, but I wouldn't have changed it because I don't live like that. I think that it's, you go through things because you're meant to go through them. And now this is the moment of healing. And I feel like this book has helped me. This moment feels like we're in a moment of healing. I don't know. I know that sounds so corny. It is what I feel right now. So
have you heard from other people who have said that in that way, they're going to share this with their family because they went through a similar circumstance?
Many, many, many people actually, which is kind of the biggest. It's like, wow, if I could, you know, if I made something that's going to help another family or another person, that's kind of the best possible outcome. But I did have two instances. So I have the book is at I made an exhibition at the International Center of Photography.
Yes.
And there was a father and a son who came to the exhibition the other day. And the son came over to me and said, you know, because there's a photograph of me and he recognized me, are you the artist? And I said, yes. And he said, he's 20 years old. He started crying. He said, I can't tell you how grateful I am. I haven't been able to really talk to my parents. You know, I'm 20, I'm in college. I've been so ashamed because they're Trump supporters and I couldn't come to terms with it. And this, nothing has touched me the way that this has touched me. And his father took him to the exhibition. His dad was there, who he's referring to as his Trump-loving dad, who he hasn't had a good relationship with. So there was something so profound about that. And I was part of that moment of them, their reckoning or their, I don't know. It was really moving.
That's wonderful. So as you mentioned, this series of photographs is an exhibition and it's on display now through January 10th at the International Center of Photography here in New York. So if anybody is lucky enough to live here or come visit here, I think what shines through in this book more than anything else is just how much love your family has for each other. And seeing as how loving and supportive as they are in the book, I wanted to ask how many times they've been to the exhibit.
They've only been twice.
So far.
So far. But I'm sure there'll be many more visits. Yeah.
And lastly, I'd love to know if there are any books that you would recommend that you've recently read and loved that you'd like to share with our listeners.
So, well, there's a book that had a huge impact on me while I was making my book. So it's not something I'm reading now, but it's something that had a huge impact on me. And it's Mira Jacobs' book, Good Talk. Mm-hmm. And it's a graphic memoir of her experience through conversation with her husband and son and in-laws who also were Trump supporters. So that book was an inspiration for me and really helped me through my journey.
Oh, that's fantastic. I've heard of that. I have to check it out.
Yeah, it's great.
Jillian, it was so nice to speak with you. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It was great talking to you.
Our late night staff is full of avid readers, and this month we asked Henry Melcher and Avery Wasson to share their book recommendations.
Hi, my name is Henry Melcher, and I'm a supervising producer at Late Night. My book recommendation is Say Nothing by Patrick Radden-Keefe. This probably isn't the most original recommendation because Patrick has been on our show to promote the book, but the book is so good that I wanted to spread the word here on the podcast as well. So Say Nothing is a gripping and remarkably human telling of the Troubles in Northern Ireland, which is a subject I knew very little about before opening this book. But it doesn't really read as a historical text because it's centered around a true unsolved murder. I won't spoil the ending, but it is stunning. You've got to read it. And the book has also been optioned for a TV series, so if you read it now, your friends will think you're super cool for having read it when the show comes out.
Hi, I'm Avery Wasson, the talent assistant at Late Night. I'd like to recommend The Alice Network by Kate Quinn. The novel is a historical fiction dual narrative thriller that can attract fans of any literary genre. Kate Quinn craftily entwines the stories of two women, a disgruntled ex-spy and a young, pregnant American socialite. With seemingly nothing in common, the two begin a journey where they ultimately share a goal, revenge. The story is based on the real-life spy ring called the Alice Network, which operated during World War I and helped infiltrate the German lines in rural France and Belgium. Eve, a fictional spy part of the network, sheds light on the significant role female operatives had during the Great War and the sacrifices they often made in the name of patriotism. As a young woman myself, I was thrilled to learn about the often unsung female war heroes, and I love any story that involves tenacious women, particularly one with an unexpected ending like this. I really hope you all enjoy it as much as I did.
This has been Late Night Lit. My thanks to Seth Meyers, Mike Shoemaker, Joe Piazza, Christine Pride, Jillian Laub, Henry Melcher, Avery Wasson, Matt Ryman, Jay Johnson, and Ross Leupold. Our theme music was written and performed by the 8G Band. For Late Night with Seth Meyers, I'm Sarah Jenks Daly. Thanks for listening and happy reading.
Murder on My Mind, a new podcast available exclusively on Wondery Plus, explores the circumstances leading up to the murder of two young men and the mistrials of the man accused of killing them. Up-and-coming rapper YNW Melly gained notoriety in the hip-hop world for his shocking lyrics and criminal exploits. When two of his best friends were gunned down in a drive-by shooting, investigators suspected the young rapper staged the scene. But after not one, but two trials that ended in hung juries and new evidence that may place YNW Melly at the scene of the crime, his trial has been paused indefinitely. With countless twists and turns, Law & Crime covers all angles of the case and begs the question, is this young artist the victim of a witch hunt or a silver-tongued devil who's evil to the core? Listen to Murder on My Mind exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.